I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Later on in the show, a conversation with two of our favorite poets, Nikki Finney and Richard Blanco, about why we need poetry to help us through these tough times. But first, nurses on the front lines of this public health crisis. In Philadelphia, Temple University Hospital is ground zero for the pandemic, with the most COVID-19 patients in the city. Caring for the critically ill is stressful under normal circumstances, but COVID-19 has made nursing even more challenging because of the needs of the patients and the threat of the virus. We asked Francine Frigie to join us. She is president of the Temple University Hospital Nurses Association, representing a staff of 1,400 nurses. And Francine Frigie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Why is Temple on the front lines of this pandemic, so many COVID patients?
Because of location. We are in the heart of the city in North Philadelphia. As you see on the news, this is affecting African Americans at a higher rate as far as hospitalizations. That is the census of most of Temple University Hospital's catchment. So while this has been going on for since March, we have had the highest census since this started in the city.
And what has it been like for nurses in particular to care for COVID-19 patients? And, you know, working at Temple University Hospital, I'm sure many used to working under really critical conditions. But what has it been like for the nurses there?
It is, as you said, it is even more so mentally and physically demanding. We are used to sick patients because of the work we do. We're one of the top lung centers in the country. We are well known for the excellent care we give to some of the sickest patients. But this is a new beast. People change very quickly. The intensity or the acuity of the patient changes at the drop of a dime. And the increased care that is needed for these patients, along with not having family members and support, is truly war zone type of physical and mental demands.
Wow. I mean, a war zone, of course, raises a whole host of issues. When you talk about the increased care, is it just that these patients are so critically ill, or as you just described, the fact that their condition can change so dramatically in such a short amount of time?
I would say it's both. They can change. They come in sick. That's why you're coming to the hospital. Most of our, as you see on the news, most of the patients that are positive and asymptomatic can stay at home. You come to the hospital because you need the care. You need the nurse's care. And they are at a more critical level because of the comorbidities they have, diabetes, hypertension. So when they decompensate, meaning they change, and need more intense care, it is quick.
Yeah.
And our ICU level of care has increased so much faster than our floor or med-surg level of care.
I'm concerned and, of course, curious about the nurses at Temple University. How many have contracted the coronavirus or test positive for COVID-19?
That is the biggest issue because of rationing of PPEs, which is going on all over the country. And we are concerned about exposure. That's one of the reasons why we have staffing issues, because we have sick nurses. We have nurses that are positive. We have other staff, ancillary staff or allied professionals that are also sick and at home are positive. So it's causing a strain. It's like a domino effect, if you will, on everyone. And everyone's safety is at risk, our patients and all of the employees.
You mentioned PPE. These are the protective gowns and masks, and I'm assuming gloves and all that you need to care for these patients. Are there shortages? Are you finding that there are just not enough to go around to meet the need?
Well, it's yes, because we're rationing. What we used to do, what we were educated to do for so many years. I've been a nurse for 25 years, over 25 years. And we've never used PPEs the way we're using them now. You know, we're reusing disposable stuff by cleaning. We get an N95 mask for one shift, where before we would change them when we would go in and out of the room. We're clustering patients in order to COVID positive patients, so we won't have to change our gown as much. We would never do that. As a matter of fact, we would get reprimanded if we did some of the practices we're doing now.
Go ahead.
That increases everyone's exposure.
We know that hospitals, even states, are in a sense competing with each other, sometimes competing with the federal government and other countries to get these protective materials. What is the administration at Temple University Hospital? What have they been able to do to help get more PPEs?
They're doing what every other area hospital is doing, and it's a competition. It's a competition of who has the most money, you know, who has the better contacts. You know, I think they work hard at trying to provide us PPEs. But Temple University Hospital, I told you where we're located. We're located right in one of the poorest zip codes in the country among large cities. Our catchment for TUH is one of the highest poverty rates in the country. And TUH is a standalone. We're not part of the university. So we don't get the big donations and the endowments of some hospitals. We rely on, we're like a public hospital, if you will. Mm-hmm. We rely on state money and Medicare and Medicaid. So our resources are slim to, I saw on the news that the Patriots chartered a plane and went to China and got, you know, masks. We don't have a plane to do that. We don't have the well-endowment funded money to do some of the things that other area hospitals are doing. We really need to level the playing field when it comes to supplies and resources, especially for the hospitals that are located in disproportionate share communities.
I mean, you are clearly on the front line, to use another battleground term, so that if there are nurses who are not coming to work because they test positive, I'm assuming then you're dealing with shortages at the hospital for those nurses who are there.
Absolutely. And that's where it's becoming, because we've been dealing with this for a long time, and we've had the census consistently the largest in the city. And that speaks to leveling the playing field as well, because not all the hospitals in the area are experiencing the short staff that we're experiencing due to the crisis going on so long for us.
Which gets us thinking, of course, about just the emotional, even mental health support and needs of nurses on the front lines. Are they getting that at Temple?
We're not. We even joked that during my rounds, I joked and we all chimed in how we're all going to need counseling. We'll have post-traumatic stress disorder from this. You know, the patients are alone. We're the only ones that are holding their hands and telling them it's okay. They don't get to see their families. And, you know, unfortunately, people die alone. And we're there. It's a mental challenge to go in every day and do this.
Yes, and I'm trying. I mean, nurses often are that person that provides that hands-on care. But as you just said, families can't come to the hospital because of safety measures. So the nurse really becomes that surrogate family member.
Yes, yes. And we take the loss very personal. We do.
Are nurses able to support each other in a sense that because you are going through this together, we can at least be together through these sad and lonely times?
Absolutely. You know, we're teams. We're teams. We support each other. We lift each other up. We count on each other. No one's turning away from doing this. We're proud of each other and supportive. I don't know what else to say on that.
Sure. No, I hear you, and I'm can only imagine that. But I'm also thinking, as you mentioned, among the poorest population in the city, if not the country, if someone then is cured and is ready to go home, do they have a home to go to? And I'm thinking of the patients, of course.
Yes, that is one of our issues with the Department of Health in the city. So if you have a patient, and we do see some homeless, we see some shelter homeless, if they're positive mm-hmm. and they're ready to go home, they can't go back to that shelter. So we need more places that will accept patients that were previously in a shelter but are now positive and ready to go home. Because since there's no place for them to go, they stay in the hospital.
Wow. And of course, staying in a hospital long term has its own, you know, potential health threats. We have just a minute or two before we have to say goodbye, but I'm also thinking that a number of states are lifting these stay-at-home orders. It hasn't happened in Pennsylvania, but we're seeing it in other states. What is your message to listeners who are home saying, I want to get my life back. I want to go shopping. I want to go to the movies. What's your message to them?
Stay home. This is real. This is dangerous. We don't know who it will hit and how it will hit. And for some people, it means death. This is serious. We need people to stay home. If we go back to work too soon, we will see more deaths. We need you to stay home.
And I'm assuming because you are on the front line, it puts even greater stresses on nurses.
Correct. We want to be safe to take care of you, to take care of us and our families as well.
Well, we're going to leave it there. And I thank you so much for the work that you and the nurses across the country are doing and for what you have been telling us about Temple University Hospital. Francine Frigie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's president of the Temple University Hospital Nurses Association. After this very short break, a conversation with two of our favorite poets. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mas Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. In these anxious and uncertain times when we're hungering at home, staying a safe distance from others, when the news is so relentless and so dispiriting, it seems we could all use some poetry. I know I could. I've always believed that poetry and radio are a good fit. They involve listening and language and a visual imagination. We've invited two of our favorite poets to join us on Radio Times, and let me introduce them to you. I first interviewed Nikki Finney about her 2011 book of poems, Head Off and Split, that won the National Book Award. Her new book, Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry, includes poems and family photos, letters, memorabilia, journals, a memoir of sorts. And Nikki Finney, it's great to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Hi, Marty. It's good to hear your voice again. Good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And let me introduce Richard Blanco. He was a guest on Radio Times last year when his latest book of poetry, How to Love a Country, was published. I also interviewed him about his memoir, The Prince of Los Cocuyos, which was published a few years ago. He was President Obama's second inaugural poet. And Richard Blanco, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. Nice to have the two of you together.
Yes, great to be here, so to speak, and so, hi, Nikki.
Yeah, here and there, and here, there, and everywhere. And to our listeners, to join our conversation, of course, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Nikki and Richard, I have a giant question to begin with, but let me toss this first to you, Nikki Finney. Does a pandemic inspire poetry or inspire you as a poet to write poetry?
Absolutely. You know, it doesn't have to be as big as a pandemic for me to be inspired to write, but absolutely it does inspire me to write. It is because there are so many things along the emotional terrain of a pandemic, it's a perfect, you know, feel for scribbling. And because we've been home and we've been enclosed and kind of shut down, it's more than perfect for the scribbling that I've been doing, let's say, for the past 50 days.
Well, I like your use of the word scribbling. Is that what poetry is for you?
Oh, it begins with that. It begins with something that I can't get out of my head, or I don't want to get out of my head, or I want to be sure and capture and catch because my mind will flip over to something else. So there are cups of pencils in every room of my house, some sharp, some not so sharp. One of the things that I was thinking of in terms of the pandemic, the question that you asked me is how I saw this, for instance, I saw this title that said it showed how quiet the world had become over the last several weeks. And I know we needed to slow down. I knew that we were, I go out on my porch and hear how quiet it had become. But I was also thinking that we were in this moment of great loss. I mean, we are in a moment of great loss. We've lost 45,000, you know, precious souls. And I don't know, I think it's 170,000 across the world. And I'm like, oh, okay. So poetry, here's this moment of great, I tell my students, of great oppositeness. Yeah. And here's this, the world saying, you know, the world has gotten so quiet. And I'm thinking about the sorrow and the screaming and the tears and the crying that those 45,000 families and those 180,000 families across the world must be experiencing. So though it may have gotten quiet because the airplanes aren't in the sky or the cars aren't on the highways, the human loss and the human sounds have absolutely, I think, been increased in this moment.
Richard, let me get you in on the conversation. I'm just curious about what this pandemic has meant for you as a poet.
Well, echoing a lot of what Nikki said, but you know, I think we always come to poetry because it makes us examine especially complex situations and emotions. It's part of why we come to poetry for weddings and births, for funerals, tragedies, cultural events, current events and whatnot. And so I think this is another occasion where there's so many mixed feelings, so many contradictions, so many opposites, so many at one time feeling sort of, you know, so much compassion and love among people and then also divide and all that. So, we poets are always kind of looking for that in the world. I find there's a little bit sometimes of an irony that I think, you know, sometimes poetry looks for the silver lining when things are really bad. And sometimes when things seem really good, we're always looking for what's not being spoken about. I'm finding myself in an interesting situation because, as Nikki was saying, there's so much quiet and I'm kind of finding a time to be quiet. I'm working on a poem or two, but also it's the first time I've ever sort of sort of addressed something that's going on right at the moment, but also it's a moving target. So, you know, like 9/11 happened, right? But then we're dealing with the aftermath and thinking about all that. And somehow I kind of had more direction on how to write something like that, with Boston Marathon bombing, I wrote something. And so with this poem, it's really been interesting because I can't sort of, every day something new, something changes, a new emotion, a little bit of hope and back to some despair. And so I'm kind of just, like Nikki said, scribbling and just thinking about, you know, what are the nuances of the things that are happening in me and outside in the world, and trying to see what that poem looks like. Also something else that he said, like, you know, not trying to write, you know, the pandemic poem,
that'll come.
All of history, but just finding a way into a poem. Right. And for me, it's been, I'm working on something that has to do with, I'm just thinking about hands as an image, the hands and the faces, you know, that are helping each other. And so I'm kind of just, you know, scribbling still too. But I agree. Every poem sort of begins with a scribble because it's just, you know, it's digging for that complexity to find those nuances, again, those contradictions. And it's a conversation, as I think Shimi Sangmi said, to some degree, you know, poem is in a way a conversation with yourself that the world overhears.
Well, and I do want to have you read, each of you read a poem, but I had, as I was putting this interview together, I was thinking about these very antiseptic and scientific words and medical words that we're using these days, COVID-19 being the obvious, pandemic, intubation, asymptomatic, social distancing. And Nikki, I don't, you know, I'm not a poet. I don't know. Are these words that could find a place in a poem?
I absolutely think there are no words that I can think of that I would hold my hand up to and say, you can't come in to the poem. I think there's a way to bring such long or edgy or, you know, medicinal or, you know, words into a poem. Yes, not all at once, not in that list, Marty.
Right, maybe, exactly.
But, you know, but there, the way, you know, one of the things I love to think about when, and Richard was talking about scribbling and writing, and, you know, it's not what you write about. It's really, you know, I tell my students, there are those, you know, 10 or 12 topics. There's love, there's death, there's marriage, there's, you know, then those are the subjects. Boom. It's not, my students always are looking, well, I don't want to write about those 12. I want to write about something new and that no one has ever written about. But it's not what you write about. It's how you think about what you write about. And so how you think about intubation, I mean, there's a, and how you think about a pandemic, not in the sort of broad strokes of, you know, of that word, perhaps as it first hits us, but, you know, narrowing the focus of the pandemic down to that mother that I saw standing in front of three caskets, her husband, her brother, and her son. That's where I go as a poet to try and enter the pandemic. So yes, that word brings me into the aura or into the space, but it's the more organic, grounded, particular, in the particular is the universal. In her, the way she's holding her hands, in the way that scarf is coming out of her, the back of her dress, in the way that her shoes, the soles of her shoes are flat, and, you know, just all of those particulars give me the entranceway to the public conversation or the public reading that I would have about the pandemic, not the Johns Hopkins numbers and not
sure.
the charts and that kind sure. of thing. So yes, absolutely.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I want to have you each read a poem. That's poet Nikki Finney, also with us, poet Richard Blanco. And yes, it is April, Poetry Month, but I think poetry can be read and written year round. Richard, you picked a poem from your latest collection of poetry, How to Love a Country, and this is called Imaginary Exile. And I wonder if you could read that for us.
Sure. So I, for this poem, I started thinking about my own mother's exile and when she left Cuba and whatnot, and thinking what would that feel like if I had to leave my home. And what I love about poems also is that you can read them again and they offer new meanings. So now I'm thinking about this poem in a different way. And the irony that now that I am stuck at home, how I'm realizing what home is much more than these four walls, much more than my yard, that it really ultimately is also about community. But it sort of recontextualizing some of what's happening. I just want to say what Nikki was saying, too, that, like, yeah, I mean, poets, as you know, it's the old show don't tell or tell by showing. We're always trying to find some tangible, tactile way to speak about something. And that is so true. Anyway, here we go. It's called Imaginary Great. Exile. Great. Dawn breaks my window and dares me to write a poem brave enough to imagine the last day I'll ever see this amber light, color the wind breathing life into the dark faces of these mountains that I know by name. Risen from the bedrock of the only country I've truly lived, resting on the same earth as this house in which I'll never rise again. A poem that captures me making my bed one last time. As the sun climbs the maples, I'll never again watch burst like fireworks into fall or undress themselves, slip into snow's white lace. Never again the spring giggles of my brook or creaks of my floor. Never the scent of my peonies or pillows. Never my eyes on my clouds or my ears to the rain on my rooftop in this country. A poem that finds a word for the emptiness of suddenly becoming a stranger in my own kitchen. As I sip my last cup of coffee, linger with the aroma of my last meal, my hands trembling as I toss leftovers, wash dishes, eat one last piece of bread I'll never break again, and cork a half-empty bottle of wine I'll never finish, a vintage I'll keep savoring like memories through my mind's palate. A poem that lists which parts of me to part with or take. Give up my orchids and dog to my neighbor Jewel, but keep our stairs goodbye. Leave the china and crystal, but box the plastic souvenirs. Forget my books, but pack every letter and card I've saved. Not the gold chains that won't buy back my life, but stuff all the loose photos like crumbs in my pockets I'll need to survive. A poem that brings daisies for my mother, holds her as I swear I'll return to hold her again, though we both know I never will. That speaks to my father one last time at his grave and forgives his silence again forever. That hopes my husband can flee with me, knowing he can't. Our last gaze, a kiss meaning more to us than our first, as I hold his hand and hand him my keys, a poem ending as I walk backwards away from his love at my door to open another, step into some strange house and country to harden into a statue of myself, my eyes fixed and crumbling like the moon, and like the moon, live by borrowed light, always, but never quite, dying in the sky, never forgiving my fate in a poem I never want to write.
Oh, it's beautiful. Richard Blanco reading Imaginary Exile. Nikki, you chose a poem for us as well, and I was wondering if you could read that as well.
Sure. This one is called, it's actually an excerpt from the Wash House Files, and it's in the new book. And it's what I used to do and what I still do 40 years, 30 years later. I go to the local washateria, even though I have a washer and dryer, because it's a meeting point for the world. Everybody comes in with dirty laundry. Yeah. And so I was thinking about that in this time.
Great.
In your country, where you are from, I don't know what your people say to you when you walk in for the first time. Do they recognize you with your dirty sack of laundry and your pencil dangling like a spider on your ear? Do your people only want something nice and clean and make it fast? Something without the stain of or ink of tomato or egg foo young? Are you allowed in your country to catch hold of the eyes of a stranger? At the Lavenderia House of Dirt, across the tracks, at the corner of 14th and Main, citizens work for a cleaner, brighter world. house of wind and water and more deeply scoured conversations. Maybe you can't venture out into your country's wash house world anymore. Maybe you have your own washer dryer at home and no need for going out. But there is always someone at the Lavanderia House of Dirt waiting for me with a gift. The young mother with the very recent and still blooming black eye walked in with her four swinging watotos and no sunglasses. She caught me staring at the new birth of her new black eye. Are you okay? I was just about to ask when she got her unbruised question out first. Sister of Anansi, she said, I meant to ask you this last week. Is all that your hair? And if it is, do you know you can speak directly with your ancestors? No call waiting, no busy signal. In your country where you are from, would you have smiled at each other like we did, held each other for a moment as if we had just discovered that we shared the same middle name, the same birthday?
And that's Nikki Finney reading from her new collection of poems, Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry. And we're almost up on our break here, but Nikki, I know your hair. You have amazing hair. Did this happen to you?
It happens to me all the time. People come up to me, and I had this hair before you could import such hair and put it on your head. And so now people come up and they say, is all that your hair? And I say, yeah, this is 37 years of growing dreadlocks. So, I get it all the time. And that's, you know, you go home and you scribble that line, and then 2 months later or 2 years later, it finds its way into a poem about being at the laundromat.
That's great. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. As I said, two of our favorite poets joining us on Radio Times, Nikki Finney. Again, she's got a new book of poetry called Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry. Richard Blanco has a book that came out just last year, a book of poems called How to Love a Country. More poetry and more conversations after this short break. Again, we want to hear from you. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, anything about poets and poetry. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain talking with Richard Blanco. He was President Obama's second inaugural poet, has a relatively new book of poems called How to Love a Country. He just read one from that collection. Also with us, Nikki Finney, and I first interviewed her back in 2011 when her book of poems, Head Off and Split, was first published. It went on to win the National Book Award. And again, she's got a new book of poems called Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry. And we want to hear from you, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I know you have both written poems for occasions, whether they were an inauguration or an event or an opening, but I was also thinking, watching, which I rarely watch now, the coronavirus task force briefings coming from the White House, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if we had a coronavirus poetry task force reading that we could hear every day? And Richard, I'd just be curious about, I forgot to throw my phone in the kitchen. So there it is. I'm home surrounded by all sorts of things here. But Richard, it's a dope, silly question, but I don't know. I feel like we need that. Maybe you could start it.
Maybe. Well, I think you've seen online, I know there's, you know, poets have certainly mobilized. Some of you have gone online. I've done online poetry readings. People are putting together conglomerations called Shelter and Poems, hashtag Shelter and Poems. So, you know, the poets have gathered around. I myself have started collecting a few poems that I've been asked to share, you know, by other poets that, you know, speak to the moment. So we kind of have been doing that a little bit. There should be a whole department of poetry, if you ask me.
Amen to that.
Branch of poetry, if you ask me. But I think, again, the poetry can offer, I think that's why people do turn to poetry in these moments, to offer another perspective, another kind of language, another kind of investigation into something that we can't quite understand. And poems come back to teach us as well. That is also very true.
Nikki, let me just ask you about the title of your new book of poems, Love Child. It is, let me say it correctly, Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry. Hotbed has so many interesting meanings. I'm curious about just where that title came from.
My father's name for me, it was a very pretty private name until I put it on the cover of this book, was Love Child. And it's also the title on the book is in his handwriting. The book itself is a minglement of many things, occasional poems, prose pieces pulled from about 50 years of journal writing. There are letters from my father to me, who he was a prolific note writer, a letter writer, and I have everything he ever wrote to me. I don't know how I managed to do that, but I do. There's a letter from my first editor of my first book when I was 26 years old in this collection. There's a photo of my mom when she was 19 across from what is titled A Hotbed, which was pulled from the journal books. And it's the hotbed is about her leaving the South and going up north to Trenton, New Jersey to work as an elevator girl in the early 1950s. But Love Child was my father's name for me, and I put it on this book because I realized that he named me that because he knew I was going into a world where black girls were called all kinds of things in the world, and not so nice things, misleading names, damaging names. And so he called me Love Child because he wanted me to know the love that I had come from the black community. He wanted me to know the love that I had come from in that household that he was creating with my mom. And so Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry is kind of like everything. A hotbed is what we gardeners use to get our spinach and kale and orchids going strong, where we put the seeds first, where we plant, fertilize, get sun and water. And so the hotbeds are really the prose, sort of condensed prose pieces that I pulled out of the journal. And when you look in the book, I hope you can tell the sort of line that goes from that scribbling that I talked about at the beginning of our conversation, and how that scribbling goes into a more condensed version, and then it's worked into the occasional poems that you also see there in the book. So it's kind of like showing you how I think as a poet, and how I scribble, and how I compose ultimately the occasional poems that you see there.
Oh, I was also thinking of a hotbed of political unrest. I mean, hotbed
can mean
different things.
Yes, absolutely. And that's there, too. I mean, when I was listening to Richard and thinking about us being here, and I love the question about there should be a response every time there's that White House briefing, you know, so that, I mean, this is just my own personal opinion, but we didn't need to lose 45,000 precious human beings. We didn't need to see the sort of incompetence that I feel very personally happening at the highest levels of government. We don't need to hear every day that First Nation people are suffering in the way that they are. I mean, part of the poet's responsibility is to echo the citizens that don't get the voice that they should have in this country. And so a lot of my poetry looks to echo what I hear back to that sorrow and back to those people occupying land and treaties, you know, 200, 300 years old that no one is paying any attention to. And now those elders are being the first ones to get COVID and the first ones to die. And so there's a whole history being lost in this country that I feel like, as a poet, I need to pay particular attention to.
Richard, I want to give you a chance to weigh in. I'm looking at the clock, and I want to make sure we have time for two more poems as well. But interestingly, you have the word love in your book of poetry as well, How to Love a Country. And you were on the show reading from it and talking about it, and just especially as someone who's, I guess, an immigrant, and what it feels like to be part of this country today.
Yeah, I mean, the title in some ways is also a question. It has a question mark behind it. And I think the book itself is an investigation of that. But also thinking about what is a country, especially in this 21st century, especially in a world that we're seeing is so interconnected. And again, not to harp, but, you know, the current crisis that we're in, we're seeing, you know, viruses have no borders, but you know, our world, our ultimate survival depends on us. Cooperation, not competition. So the book is an investigation of that. It's also, you know, what is a country, and you know, how do we start to define that these days? There's not this thing of, you know, no longer this idea, this sort of 19th century, 18th century idea of a country with a neat border. You know, we're all in this together, and we're all connected. And you know, even when you start thinking about things like climate change, you know, it ultimately depends on our interconnection. So in a way, it's, you know, I think what is one of the challenges of, or at least one of the challenges that I'm working on in the in that book is, you know, how to celebrate one's diversity, how to celebrate different cultures, how to dig up the history of those cultures, like Nikki was referring to, how to acknowledge our past, and yet sort of move forward as one people, as one world, not just one country. And so the book sort of has that arc in there. It's something that, again, tied to my own sort of very personal investigation of trying to understand, since I was 5 years old, where is it that I do belong, you know, on all those questions that came to bear in my life. Also as a gay man, another kind of identity, another kind of belonging. So, yeah, I always say it's a question, and also kind of a self-help book.
Right. Well, we could all use some self-help. Exactly. Poetry is self-help. Nikki, I'd love to have you read another poem. You sent one to us. This is Hotbed number 11. I wonder if you could just do a short little intro, and then we'll hear the poem, and then Richard will hear your poem.
My grandmother used to wait at the front door when I told her I was coming to see her, and I just could not. She wouldn't move. She would just stand there until she saw me. And I always wanted to write, you know, folded arms, screen door, and I always wanted to write something for that kind of waiting, that enduring kind of love. And so this is called Hotbed 11. There are women who wait at the door until you arrive like you said you would. Women who stand at the screen with their elbows poking in at the wire like original knob and tube. There are women who wait at the door until your car rolls up in the yard, the engine cut, the headlights shut, the driver's door cracking the air into two slices of brown bread. There are women who stare from one pecan tree to another until all the pecans are on the ground, all along the front walk, until the wobbly threshold is filled with the sound of the shoes of the one who left the war he was in to go fight a war he was not. Women who would rather be flunked or fired than miss the arrival of the one they have not seen since the last time they saw her, without a baby in her arms, without a monkey on his back, without a dark piece of hammer hair crawling up his cheek like a new man.
I love that. Nikki Finney reading from her new collection of poems, Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry. Richard, you picked another poem from How to Love a Country. This is called Cloud Anthem. Can you read that to us?
Sure. And this relates back actually to what we were talking about sort of coming together and using clouds as a tangible sort of grounding device and a metaphor for thinking about that. Cloud Anthem. Until we are clouds that tear like bread but mend like bones, until we weave each other like silk sheets shrouding mountains or bear the gales that shear us, until we soften our hard edges, free to become any shape we imagine, a rose or an angel crafted like papier-mâché by breezes, or a lion or a dragon like marble chiseled by gusts. Until we scatter ourselves into pebbles of gray puffs, then band together like stringed pearls. Until we learn to listen to each other, as thunderous as opera or as soft as a showered lullaby. Until we truly treasure the sunset, lavish it in mauve, rust, and rose. Until we have the courage to vanish like sails into the horizon, or be at peace, anchored still. Until we move without any measure, as vast as continents or as petite as islands, floating in an abyss of virtual blue we all belong to. Until we dance tango with the moon and comfort the jealous stars falling. Until we care enough for the earth to bless it as morning fog. Until we realize we're as muddy as puddles, as pristine as lakes, not yet clouds. Until we remember we're born from rivers and dewdrops. Until we're at ease to dissolve as wispy showers, not always needing to clash like godly yells of thunder. Until we believe lightning isn't our right to the ground. That we can collude into storms that ravage. We can also sprinkle ourselves like memories. Until we tame the riot of our tornadoes, settle down into a soft drizzle, into a daydream. Though we may curse with hail, we can absolve with snowflakes. We can die valiant as rainbows and hold life like blood in our lucid bodies. We can decide to move boundlessly without creed or desire until we are clouds, meshed within clouds. Sharing a kingdom with no king, a city with no walls, a country with no name, a nation without any border or claim, until we abide as one in one single sky.
And again, Richard Blanco reading from his book of poetry, How to Love a Country, that's Cloud Anthem, and it's beautiful. You know, sometimes the clock is my friend and sometimes it's my enemy. So today it's my enemy because I see the minutes are ticking away. But Nikki, I ran across an interview with you. It was in a publication, Teachers and Writers, and you talked about your parents taking you to the airport. There were certain rituals and things that they did, that your dad gave you money, your mom gave you whatever was in her pocket. But this, I just wanted to read a couple of lines of what you said about them. They park, they go as far as they can go and then turn around. It's the ritual of releasing me to the universe. We don't do this anymore. Sometimes I wish we'd think more about how we leave each other and how we might never see each other again. That's my charm. And when I read that, I just felt like it just spoke to, I think, how so many of us are feeling now, that we're connected, but we're losing people, and we're just filled with all these memories of family and our past. And I'm giving you no time to respond to that, but I'd just be curious about your thoughts.
I feel like every day I wake up, I feel my eyes taking photographs of the things around me and the people around me. My mom is 86 and she's stowed away, and she'll let me bring the grocery bag to the driveway and drop them off. She's very independent, fiercely independent, doing well, doing, you know, her yoga, eating some tofu, and hugging her little puppy and trying to stay safe, as we all are. But every time I see her, my eyes click and take a picture of her, because I always think of that poem. It's a very short poem, but I always think I might not see her again, because there's so many stories like that in the air right now.
Well, I wish we could go on, but my thanks to both of you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Nikki Finney, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Marty. And Richard, I send a hug across the way.
Same here, Nikki. Same here.
Nikki Finney, Richard Blanco, our guests on Radio Times. Nikki Finney's new book of poems, Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry. Richard Blanco's most recent book of poems, How to Love a Country. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.